Okay, hey everybody, this is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman back with you for the 41st, count them, 41 Grassroots Emergency Election Protection Coalition Zoom calls. Those of you listening in with us from the Progressive Radio Network, we are thrilled to have you with us at PRN. We do not start with Pete Seeger anymore, but we will maybe bring him back. We have 65 people on the call so far. Usually it goes up a little more. We are thrilled with the quality and quantity of the wonderful people who tune into this Zoom call. For you in PRN land, when it gets to be an hour, we're going to lose you. So go to electionprotection2024.org and pick up the link and you can continue. We will go to 6:40 Eastern time, and then we'll turn off the recording and then we'll probably talk for another hour or so, which we have been doing. Today we're really gonna focus with the great Ray McClendon from the Atlanta NAACP, who's gonna give us a big deep rundown, courtesy in part of Andrea Miller, on HR1 and then HR4, which is being renamed, and then the real serious assault that's being raised against democracy all over the country, mostly at the state level, in swing states that have gerrymandered legislatures. This is the critical problem facing American democracy, certainly one of the top problems facing us today. And Ray McClendon of the Atlanta NAACP is gonna fill us in. We're gonna have quickly Jennifer Tanner and then Joel Siegel. Jennifer, you conducted a meeting on Friday, that went a couple hours, and you may want to do it again. So give us a rundown how that worked and how we can do it again, or you can.
So it was really good. A lot of people showed up, and what we decided is we picked five issues that we wanted to deal with. Instead of doing everything, we spent about a half hour on each one, and everyone gave their comments. We have video, which we've shared with the Grassroots Google group email. And then we also have a chat that Julie Wiener kindly edited for us. And that has also been shared. So all the information is there. It's a lot to process.
Okay, and you put the links in the chat and—
I didn't put the links in the chat.
Okay, send them to Steve Caruso, he will. And you're gonna
sent the chat. I sent all of that. So hopefully Steve can put that in. I don't have it in front of me. Yes, and then if people want to vote on this and want to do it, we could do another one this coming Friday at 2:00 if that works for everybody.
Okay, so you'll put the details in the chat. You'll work it out with Steve Caruso. And
I don't know if everybody wants to do it. I mean, maybe people could vote on it or we get some kind of feedback.
No, just put it up there and see who shows up. And I think that's the best way to do it.
People don't really want to do it. Maybe one was enough. I don't know. Well, I mean, there is people.
Excuse me. Sorry, Jennifer. I'll put the link up in the upcoming Zooms on grassrootsep.org. So if there is a meeting and you guys decide that, then we will go from there.
We will inform
If anybody wants to join a listserv and see the links, we can put you in the listserv and you can join in the discussion there.
Okay, great. Wonderful. That's a great way to do it. Thank you, Steve.
Honestly, Harvey, there was a lot of people that wanted to have the first one. You asked me to lead it and I did. I'm not going to show up and maybe nobody's there. If I plan, I want to know the people want to be there. I think it's
Let's put it off a week. We'll discuss it off camera.
That's fine.
We won't do it this week and we'll talk about it through the week and we'll see if we can come up with something. Okay, Jennifer? Fine. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Great. Thank you, Jennifer. I'm glad you had that meeting. It did go 2 hours. I was in part of it, watched part of it on the tape. It was very productive and you do a great job of moderating. So thank you so much, Jennifer Tanner. Joel Siegel, we were going to have Domingo Garcia today. He postponed until next week. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, he he was just at the a grieving family, I believe in Houston. There was a 11-year-old child that died of hypothermia in a trailer park. And so he just called me and said he couldn't make it. He'll be on next Friday. I do want to say that Jennifer, she did an outstanding job, by the way, on the call in terms of, you know, HR one, and the people who were on the call were really tremendous. They really knew their stuff. Did you want me to talk a little bit? I can kind of
briefly. I want to talk very quickly about Texas, because as many of you know, I do energy work as well, alternative energy, anti-nuclear stuff. I don't know if this shows up, my no nukes t-shirt. There was a lot of talk in Texas, and I'll do this quickly, about the failure of the windmills there. And, you know, about a quarter of the windmills did go down. That's the fault of the people who put in the windmills, though, in Wisconsin, where it's more regularly cold, those windmills are not affected. So the renewable energy industry is not perfect, but I do want to mention, and you never saw this in any major media, that one of the major reactors, nuclear reactors at the South Texas nuclear plant froze. The intake pipes froze, and they had to shut that reactor for 2 full days, more than 1,000 megawatts. So, which is more than the wind, more than the wind. And so, you know, this idea that the wind and the renewables were at the heart of the problem in Texas is completely insane, very political. And the situation with the nuclear plant at STMP was extremely dangerous. The feed water pipes just flat out froze. And the reactor had to shut because they didn't have any coolant, for God's sakes. So let's keep that in mind. And we're sorry that Domingo couldn't come today. We are very much with him in consoling people in Texas. And Joel, as you pointed out to me in an earlier conversation, the real problem there is they don't have a democratic government with a small D, right? There's no democracy in Texas. And that's one of the things that we're about on these calls, is correcting the political system.
Well, they refuse to be part of the national electric grid. And what Domingo told me was, in Chicago, in other areas where they had, you know, freezing weather, the grid stayed on. But in Texas, in order to get on away on the cheap, they never weatherized their electric grid. They bought the cheapest wind turbines. They're blaming AOC, by the way, for all their problems. But they didn't have any de-icing on the windmills because they wanted to get away on the cheap. But the other problem is Texas has a secessionist movement, and they don't believe in the government, right? So now you got a lot of people who are dead. A lot of them are Hispanic. We got James Fukuda from LULAC here, and this is a tragedy that could have been avoided. But everything that we're working on, whether it's climate change or housing or poverty, election protection, if we do not deal with voter suppression, election protection, and the Congress keeps flipping and these state legislatures stay red, it doesn't matter what issues we're working on, we're gonna run up against a brick wall. This is why this conversation is so important.
James Fukuda, you've faced a lot of issues like this with housing in New York City. Does this people getting frozen in the middle of winter look familiar to you?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. We are having that problem in the city right now with NOS and NYCHA, the New York City Housing Authority, which only has 174,000 units. It's a small city all by itself.
Unbelievable. And the people are freezing, right? I will point out, some guy in Texas got an electric bill for about $17,000. Because they jacked the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, Jerry Jones, jacked up energy prices. He was thrilled with the big freeze because he made, you know, millions and millions of dollars. And meanwhile, working people are getting energy bills, electric and gas, tens of thousands of dollars. It's astounding. Just no end to it. Okay, we're going to go to Ray McClendon in shortly, but two great of our great stalwarts here have their hands, Lulu Freestat and then Julie Wiener. Lulu, you with us?
Thank you very much, Harvey. I just want to let people know that we are having a forum focusing on the progressive and the conservative criticisms of HR1 tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Howie Hawkins is going to be our guest on the call. I did put the information in the stack, and I'll put it in again. Howie, I was on Jennifer's call. Jennifer, thanks. That was a great call. And Howie brought up some really concerning issues in terms of the campaign finance and how private money is going to be allowed to expand into the main committees, the Democrat and National, you know, that's the Democratic National Committee, the Republican National Committee, are increasing their limits, he says, from 5,000 to, I believe it was 100 million each. So it's a huge increase there. And he brought up some other very concerning things about the campaign finance part of HR1. And we're going to fact check that and go into detail on it, and also try to collate some of the issues that were brought up on Jennifer's call and come up with specific solutions or suggestions for the bill, as well as going to election security.
That's tomorrow. At what time, Lulu?
7 p.m. Eastern time. And I will put the link in the chat again. It's the Smart Elections Election Protection Forum. Thank you so much for letting me tell people, Harvey. I probably won't stay on the call the whole time, but I really appreciate this call.
Well, you're one of the greats. We really appreciate you, Lulu, and your work has been absolutely tremendous. Julie Wiener, another one of our stalwarts. Do you want to jump in, Julie?
Thanks. Yes, Lulu, it's a huge contribution if you're going to try and consolidate all of those programmatic points. There, Lulu took notes of the live meeting. I consolidated the chat. In Lulu's summary are links to about five different groups that also have developed programmatic points. There was a lot of discussion toward consolidating, but if your group is volunteering to do all that consolidation, Lulu, that's great. I was going to ask for a volunteer because it's maybe there are eight program points. And if we can come together and underline them and get them to Sarbanes or Sarbanes, whatever he said, whatever he
said. Sarbanes.
Sarbanes et al.
Okay. Awesome. All right, very good. Very, thank you for that. The work is tremendous. The information is in the chats. By the way, I put up a piece yesterday at Reader's Supported News, doing something I never thought I'd do. I slammed the New Yorker magazine, which used to be one of the highest quality magazines in the country. They ran an insanely stupid piece on nuclear power. I put the link in there. It's about as nasty as I could make it. So if any of you want to take a look at that, please go to Reader Supported News. And as I say, the link is in the chat. Okay, Ray McClendon, we are going to jump into the deep, deep weeds here. We need to deal with HR1. HR4, according to Andrea Miller, is going to be renamed. It's really the old Civil Rights Act in many ways. And on top of that, you being in the belly of the beast in Atlanta, this massive, massive counterattack on voting rights nationwide, but primarily in the swing states with the red legislatures. That is the most critical threat to our democracy in a long, long time. It's like a national Ku Klux Klan assault on American voting. So Ray McClendon, a political director of the Atlanta NAACP, we're up to 80 people now, and the floor is yours. Tell us, please, what's going on.
Okay, thank you so much. Harvey, I appreciate the opportunity to be with such great patriots in the true sense of the word.
Yeah, right.
Whoever's controlling the feed here, if you could give me the rights to share my screen, then I'll share some of the talking points that Andrea Miller put together so we can go through that. But let me tell you why it's important. It's important because of what we're going through here in Georgia. Everybody knows the kind of commitment we made, and thanks to all of you all for volunteering and supporting the effort. Many came to Georgia and helped support. And of course, we've got a major backlash going on now in both the state House and Senate. There are close to 40 bills in the Senate that deal with a whole host of issues. We've talked about them in the past. Some outlaw the no excuse absentee balloting altogether for everyone except for those over 75 years of age. They are eliminating drop box locations, eliminating weekend voting, early voting hours. Providing for ways to continue to do voter purges, coming up with additional election officials that potentially could have the power to usurp county registrars, providing for in the early voting on weekends is a big issue in the Black community because we've had a tradition of doing souls to the polls on Sundays. And that was a direct slap in the face to many of our constituents in the NAACP. Although there are multiple bills in the Senate, there's one omnibus bill in the House Bill 531 that is moving through and has many of these same provisions that are in the Senate are in the House. Now we're battling these on both fronts. They've been having meetings as early as 7 a.m. in the morning, hearings. These hearings are ongoing now. In fact, the Senate is in session as we speak. And I've got folks monitoring that Senate Ethics Committee hearing. The Special Integrity Committee in the House is nefarious in that it takes all of these, puts them in one bill, and they have the votes to pass it. In Georgia, as many of you know, Republicans control the governorship, the House, and the Senate, and they have for almost two decades now. So we anticipate that some form of these bills will pass. Now you might ask, why are there so many bills? Well, because they do this in Georgia, where they can begin to put different pieces of legislation in different bills, have them teed up, and there's in Georgia we have crossover. Crossover is the day when bills in one house have to be passed and then crossover to the other chamber. That date is coming up sometime within the next week. At that time, whatever bill passes, that bill then can be amended in the opposite house. So all of the bad stuff that didn't get through can still be added. So there'll be a lot of backroom dealing that will be going on starting after crossover day to the end of the session. For that reason, it's very difficult to try to negotiate. You can't negotiate effectively because once you think you have killed a bad amendment or bad provision, it can still rear its ugly head in the bill once it crosses over. So as of right now, what we're doing is we are opposing all voter suppression bills, not negotiating on any of the points, and supporting legislators who are pro voting rights to maintain that provision. We met with several of the leaders in the House and Senate last night. We had over 80 participants leaders from around the state of various civic and civil rights organizations involved, and that's our position. We've been using the Action Network tools in conjunction with Andrea Miller and Center for Common Ground, shout out to them, where we've been bombarding legislators in the Senate Ethics Committee and in the Select and Election Integrity Committee in the House with our opposition. Tomorrow at 11 a.m., we will have a protest rally across the street from the Capitol, from the state Capitol, voicing the opposition from many of the groups that participated with us in the statewide coalition to get out the vote. We'll also be having a virtual rally, which I'll get more information out to you on later. But we're still at a disadvantage, but the good news is that people are fighting. We're also encouraging all of you to help us participate in that. There are ways that you can. I will put some things in the chat here in a little bit, where one of the tools that we have in conjunction with Center for Common Ground and the Action Network has been to recalibrate the phone banks so that our phone banking that we used for GOTV, K can now be utilized to reach out to voters with a script that will alert them to what's going on in the state legislature. And the scripts have downloaded in the scripts the way to put that voter in touch with their specific state representative or legislator. So that's what we're about, but we still feel like we brought a knife to a gunfight. And that leads us to HR 1. The reason that HR 1 is so important is that it levels the playing field. So instead of us and other state organizations having to fight this battle against a combined enemy, many of the challenges that we have would be dealt with directly in HR 1. So we're going to be very strong for HR 1. And certainly, I don't want to try to spend time. Many of you know more about HR 1 than I do. But our focus is on the voting rights components of HR 1. And that's what I'd like to spend some time on. If we can share the information, Harvey.
Yes, please do. Go ahead. Absolutely.
Okay.
Do you have are you able to put it up there?
I'm getting ready to put it up now.
All right. Now, I want to make now, and of course, what's going on in Georgia is going on all over the country. For example, in Arizona, the Republican legislature wants to usurp the right to appoint electors. They don't even want to bother really having a statewide presidential election. And this is going on all over the country. So Ray, go ahead, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, HR 1 for the People Act, these are the components that we are excited about that we will be supporting because of what we're under attack with in Georgia. All states will have no excuse early voting. As I said, we have SB 71 here that will deny us that right. This would supersede that. All states will have no excuse vote by mail. All states will have same day voter registration. All states will have one provision I want to tell you about that they're trying to pass here because of the runoff is that if you move to the state of Georgia after the general election, you cannot register and vote in a runoff election, which is crazy. All states will have online voter registration. All states will have, we currently have an opt-in program. They're trying to reverse the, opt-out program, say when you get your driver's license renewed, they're trying to reverse that. All states will have automatic voter registration. And you'll be able to register as late as election day. It prohibits states from requiring full social security numbers. An estimated, we know that this is a big problem, especially in low income and communities of color. The restoration in federal elections, an estimated 5.2 million people cannot vote due to felony disenfranchisement. In six states that are listed here, more than 5% of the total voting age population is disenfranchised. And the part of the disenfranchisement is disingenuous to an insidious extent where in many cases, those states also require you to complete any kind of restitution and any kind so that can extend the disenfranchisement well beyond the payment of debt to society. In some states we have Virginia, Kentucky, Iowa, and Florida. They are lifetime felony disenfranchisement states. And we know the significance of those. Again, as I mentioned, rights are restored after release from prison, which is important. There's no requirement to pay the fines, restitutions, and penalties after a waiting period. Early voting must begin at least 15 days before the election. Again, our time frames have been longer than that. They are now in Georgia cutting those times back to a minimum period. Early voting times must be before 9 a.m. and continue after 5 p.m. Early voting hours must be consistent throughout the period, and early voting is available to all eligible voters. Again, we're seeing attacks on all of these points except the fourth point here in Georgia right now. Vote by mail is probably the most significant component that's going on with us here in Georgia, as it is in several other states. Vote by mail has to be available to all voters according to the For the People Act. States may not curtail eligibility. Again, this is a big issue here. We're battling it, and we're hoping that we'll be able to maintain it, but this would take it off the table. States may not require any identification as a condition of obtaining a ballot. Here in Georgia, one of the things that's occurring is that not just one photo ID is required, but you have to copy photo ID twice. Again, many of your low-income voters don't have access to printers, and therefore this is certainly a burden. States may not require witness signature or notarization as a condition of obtaining or casting a ballot. Once again, these are solutions in search of problems. Many of you know the recounts that we had here in Georgia. We also had a 15,000 ballot audit in one of our largest counties, Cobb County here, and they found no evidence of any kind of fraud related to absentee ballots. There's also no limit on the number of ballots a person may deliver or drop off. Again, this is one of the things that the NAACP would be curtailed from doing, as we have been here in Georgia. We have worked with nursing homes around the state to help to go in, make sure that the ballots were gathered up and then dropped off either in drop boxes or at the registrar's office. The reason that we have the polarization that we do, and the reason that it's difficult to dislodge the dominance of the two chambers being within power and within the control of one party here in Georgia, along with the governorship, is because of the gerrymandering, as you all know, and this independent commission for redistricting is something that would really be a significant enhancement and allow us to get equity and have voters choose their elected officials and not elected officials choose their voters. As we do, many of our NAACP chapters, we do the canvassing inventory lists for them. And when you look at the way that some of these different counties have been carved up, it is amazing. I know that Joel Siegel and I have talked about how in North Carolina they have literally cut a line through one of the historically Black colleges and universities there in North Carolina in order to dilute the Black vote. That's consistently done in Georgia, and this would be a major help in taking politics out of the congressional redistricting. And then save voters.
One thing, Ray.
Yes, go ahead.
In the federal law, this does deal with gerrymandering for the congressional districts, but the bill, as I understand it, does not have any power over state legislature district drawing. Is that correct?
That's correct. But the challenge is that if we can get this done for federal elections, which would include for president, for Congress, both representatives and senators, then they would have to have a whole different system to maintain gerrymandering in the state and local races. And that would be a tremendous financial burden, and it would be a major hurdle for them to justify why it is that they will have to bifurcate federal versus state and local. Not to say they won't try to do it, but it will be a significant financial and logistical hurdle to try to strip out state and local.
That's a very interesting point. I do want to point out, people want to get deeper into this. In California, I believe it was 2008 and 2010, they had separate referenda statewide, one to set up what we now have, which is a statewide districting commission, which is nonpartisan. It's actually a very, very good commission, but they had to have two separate referenda, one for the congressional districts, federal, and then another for the state legislature, but they did it and they both passed. I just want to point that out. That's an important precedent here. And people who are interested in this should look at the actual commission in California, because it's actually a very good model. Okay, sorry for that, Ray. Go ahead.
Oh, no problem. No, that's a great point to make. But I think this is a big point as to whether or not I see Robin Gibson raised a hand. Which you have a question?
I do for you, Ray. One of the things that you brought up about HR 1 was that you guys have been taking votes for senior citizens, taking their ballots in for them. And I understand how important that is in the South, in Georgia, in some areas. At the same time, that is one part of HR 1 that all of the people working on election protection are concerned with, because a lot of election fraud happens, in fact, by election officials. And this is one of the things that they do. And we have found that in California for more than 15 years. Stepping the ballot box, in other words.
Yeah. Let's let Ray answer that. And then we'll get through his presentation, and then we can have questions.
Okay. No, he asked. Okay. So yeah, go ahead. We all believe that has to be removed, that passage saying that you can take as many ballots as you want. And we talked a lot about how to solve the issue for people who can't get their ballot in. So we thought, part one, family members can take ballots. And the only thing we don't know how to do, that's why I'm bringing it up to you, is what to do about assisted living in senior homes.
Very good.
Good question. That's a great question. So we'll talk about that further, but I can say that's exactly who we've been dealing with.
Right.
As I said, it was specifically nursing homes. But in any event, we'll talk about that. We can get into that some more. We're open to suggestions. But many of these folks don't have family to visit. We were in the middle of a pandemic this year, and we were working with the administrators at the nursing homes to ensure that especially with what DeJoy was doing to the U.S. Postal Service, we wanted to ensure that those votes were indeed counted and then get lost in the shuffle. But I appreciate
absolutely.
You.
Right. Yeah,
very good. Okay, let's let Ray, I know Brian, you have a hand, but let's let Ray get through the whole
thing. Okay, great. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, almost finished here. So another thing that's happened that we've dealt with is voter purges. Voter purges is a big issue. As many of you know, the current governor was the Secretary of State. He managed over 330,000 voter purge right before his election in 2018. As many of you might remember, that Stacey Abrams lost by 55,000 votes. The numbers were disproportionately African American and people of color that were removed. So HR 1 helps deal with that that issue as well, and it's critical here in the South. Also, once again, we talk about the official residence of incarcerated individuals is their last residence prior to incarceration. So that concludes what I want to talk about voting. And I wanted to share with you again, Andrea, what Andrea has been working on with that. Of course, there are other provisions in HR1, but I wanted to have us focus solely on why it's so important with what we are literally battling with day to day here in Georgia and other states.
Well, as we mentioned, what's happening in Georgia is happening all over the country, especially in Pennsylvania and Arizona. Those are the two that have jumped out. I mean, literally the state legislature in Arizona wants to abrogate the ability to choose the delegates to the Electoral College. I mean, they're basically saying they're reverting back to 1789 and saying that the state legislatures should elect the president. And that's going to pop up wherever there are gerrymandered legislatures. Ray, you want to take a couple questions?
Sure, be happy to.
Okay, Brian Steinberg, you've got a question, please. Brian? Hold on.
Can't hear you. You're on mute.
There he is. Okay.
Yeah. Right, so a lot of great stuff on there. I will concur, too, with what a person who talked about having a problem with just unlimited ballots being delivered. That's a problem here. There was a problem in North Carolina with someone just collecting people's ballots and throwing them out in a congressional election. But in Michigan, we are allowed to deliver ballots for people in your same household and in your same family. And I think you even have to sign your form saying you give permission. But I want to talk about something else, though, is that wasn't in the permission provisions so far, at least I didn't see, is drop boxes. We've done a lot of great work here in Michigan, certainly in Georgia too. And the drop box standard basically is anywhere from 10 to 15,000 voters. There needs to be a drop box available for that amount of voters. We just put in 32 drop boxes for the city of Detroit, which meets that standard for its 500,000 voters. The big thing about voter enfranchisement with drop boxes is that a lot of communities, especially communities of color, don't have access to good transportation. So drop boxes really do a lot of heavy lifting to allow people to have access to be able to walk to vote, easier access to voting. They're usually put at fire stations, city halls, community centers, and at senior centers. And just a little thing about senior centers, my father, who lives in a senior center in Florida, people literally from the clerk or whatever, they come in and they literally bring in a voting machine and they literally can vote right in their development, in their dining area. So people literally do come in to help seniors in the state of Florida. And that's something that could be a larger conversation. So anyway, I would like to see drop boxes in there, because if you add up all the drop boxes that are needed for the entire country, let's just say the entire African-American population, 30, maybe 40 million people, divide that by 15,000, divide that by 2,000 per drop box, we're really only talking about anywhere from $2 to maybe $5 million to buy a drop box for every single African-American voter to have a 15,000 voter standard, to have one drop box for every 15,000 voters. And these boxes last literally for decades. It's super cheap. It's cheaper. It's so cheap to get dropped.
Let me respond to that, though, and just let you know that, again, here in Georgia, they're going the opposite direction from that. They are curtailing the number of drop boxes in the legislation. They are also restricting the times for when you can use drop boxes and the locations. They would only be in precincts and only available to drop off during times of early voting. So, and they're trying to cut back on the time for early voting. So it's going in the absolute opposite direction from that.
Brian, two things. First of all, how much does a single drop box generally cost? What's the price range of a drop box? You bought a lot of them in Michigan. How much were they? Or you're muted. There we go. Wait.
Unmute, trying, okay, yeah. So, well, there's a bunch of companies, and the company that we use, a stainless steel Dropbox, stainless steel, weatherproof, right? Really good, secure. They can hold up their, like, I think 2,000 ballots at a time. And, you know, that's a day, and they can be empty throughout the day.
Those how much?
$2,000, basically, per Dropbox.
Right.
So you're talking, out of 15,000 people, you're saying it's really 7.5 cents per voter to have a Dropbox. That's it.
Do they stay for the whole time, or are they removed after elections and then reinstated? Again, you're muted.
I mean, okay, so they literally could be, you could put a magnet on there and change the like logo on there, and they could be used to actually collect, you know, water bills, etc., or they can be used exclusively during elections. There could be an either or. A lot of drop boxes now are multi-purpose. They're just slots in the city hall. They're just other separate boxes. Some have a separate one just for ballots, another one for bill collection. Yeah.
Wow.
So, the thing is, they last literally for decades. They cost its initial investment of 7.5 cents per voter. That's for 1 year. If they last for 2 years, that's half, and then half again. They literally cost next to nothing, and they really enfranchise voters, especially during COVID. You can use them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to drop off your ballot. I mean, I've been, you know, really a big advocate for it. We fought to have this in Michigan. And of course, they have them in Georgia now, and they want to take them away. So obviously, it's a big issue. So it's something to talk about.
And I want to say there's been articles in the media about how most people, many observers are saying that the Florida election was actually extremely well run, except for the disenfranchisement of ex-felons who hadn't paid their fees. And the legislature now in Florida is busy tearing apart the whole voting methods. And they are also, as you mentioned, they're getting rid of drop boxes in Florida. This is one of the things that we need to look at nationwide on this big purge of voting procedures. Ray, did you want to comment on that? What did you say that the bill says about drop boxes, or does it say anything about drop boxes?
I don't know what it says specifically about drop boxes. I was dealing with what we're fighting here in Georgia.
Okay, so we should look at HR1. I don't know if there's anything specific in HR1 about drop boxes or not, but we should find out.
It says nothing about drop boxes in the bill.
Okay, thank you, Robin. Well, it's something we need to look at then.
Absolutely.
Be high on our list, absolutely. Okay, very quickly, Jeffrey Barkdoll. Did anybody else have a hand that wanted to jump in?
Again.
Art Levine has a hand.
And then Art Levine after Jeffrey, go ahead.
All right. Remember when you said voting purges? Do you think that people who are members of hate groups should not be allowed to vote?
Oh God.
You know, like neo-Nazis, the Ku Klux Klan, those kind of people. Do you think they should not be allowed to vote?
Well, it's here. Well, do people, Joel Siegel, you've talked a lot about that, and Ray McClendon, do members of the Ku Klux Klan lose their right to vote? I don't see it, but
I don't either.
There is on the books, by the way, from Reconstruction under Ulysses S. Grant, there is a law that bans the Ku Klux Klan, but it's over 150 years old. It certainly hasn't been enforced for quite a while.
That's why old laws, you know, that never got put into place should be put into a vault where they can be reopened for future use.
Yes. Okay. Including the Voting Rights Act, which we're trying to get back since the Supreme Court struck it down. There's a big issue. Someone else had a hand, and then I want to ask.
Yes, Ray. I have had a hand.
Art Levine.
Okay. Three quick questions that are very, I think, strategically important. One, Ray. Is the new Biden DOJ civil rights unit that's not been defanged by conservatives and Trump going to do anything about this, even with the Supreme Court, Civil Rights Act gutted in 2013? That's the first. Second, national groups with local affiliates and chapters, are they working hard on this, or where are they? And third, what's the best way that we national activists and advocates can help support all the horrible stuff going on in your state and other states. Because at this point, it's basically occasional hand-wringing news coverage, horrible vote suppression, and I don't know what the responses should be in those three areas. So I'd love to hear your views.
Yeah. First of all, let me talk before I get into DOJ. Let me talk about what we're doing right now. Is we're battling every day. Every day we are sending letters from constituents. We are making phone calls to the senators and representatives. We're having a press conference tomorrow at the Capitol to let our voices be heard. And again, these are the same groups that we organized for the election. We are now re-energized and refocusing our efforts directly on these voter suppression tactics. The great thing was the nation got behind Georgia for the elections and particularly the runoffs. And we can do it again. I put in the chat the phone banking platform that we have, that we work in partnership with Andrea Miller's Center for Common Ground. And as I said, that's one way that all of you and others can share and get involved, where we need to bombard these people with notice that we are watching what we're doing, and then we're not going to take this sitting down. We have never been organized to go after any swing districts in the state legislature. This is being teed up as the evolution of this will be for those who we identify that are vulnerable. This is the beginning of the groundwork for that, where we can begin to try to take back some of these state legislatures. So all of this is working toward a culmination in 2022 and beyond. So we won't have a repeat in 2022 of what happened in 2010. So this is we got to have the long game here. I think HR1 and HR4 is where we need to spend our attention. I think although I have high hopes for DOJ and particularly for Attorney General designee Garland, it's going to take some time for it to work from the Justice Department standpoint, but we've got to be focused on how we're going to break the filibuster in the Senate and get multiple bills passed right away. We need to use all of the energy that we put into getting two senators elected in Georgia, a Black and a Jewish senator from Georgia, and the heavy lift that was should pay off, and they need to use this effort now to make sure that relief passes in the $1.9 trillion bill, and that we figure out how, and that will be done through budget reconciliation. So all they need is a simple majority in the Senate. But we've got to figure out how we can overcome filibuster for those bills. And we need to do that right. We need to do that right away. And we need to not be ashamed about it.
I have a very important follow-up point on filibuster, just to let you know about it, that hasn't gotten as much traction. Norm Ornstein and Al Franken are promoting the notion of requiring and changing the filibuster to require 41 votes in opposition so that it forces all Republicans to be their own Jimmy Stewarts to stop stuff rather than have a 60 vote thing to margin. And that seems to me a proposal that could win over people like Manchin. So I want to put that out there, put in the op-ed, and if progressives got behind that, it could make a big difference, okay?
Now, that's great. So that's the kind of tactical and strategic maneuver that we need to spend some time on. We must get as much done as we can during 2021. And we don't need to fiddle around on this and go to where our strength is. We put this majority in place for a reason. Let's make it work for us and demand that.
There's just one problem.
And
let me go ahead.
Joel Siebel.
Yeah, first of all, Arthur, those are great questions, by the way. Ray, thank you for incredible explanation of HR1. So I spoke to a very senior person who would like for me not to use his name on the Judiciary Committee. But when I say senior, I mean senior. So here's what's going down in the Congress. HR1 will come to a vote in March. They got 218 votes. They were at 217, they're at 218 now. They're trying to make it what they call litigation proof. This is not meant to, you know, I don't want to be a bummer. But we got the filibuster, but the reason why we're gonna have to have a powerful movement, maybe something we haven't seen since the 60s, probably even much, much bigger than the 60s. And that's gonna be the possibility of the Supreme Court. Who's going to, you know, there'll be attorney generals across the country, Republican attorney generals, who are going to fight like hell to make sure HR1 does not become implemented. In terms of HR4, they're trying to make that litigation proof. And the intel that I have is it could be anywhere from 3 to 4 months before that's introduced. It's something that I hope we can discuss next week, because I think that's too long. Having worked on the Hill for many years and been a lobbyist there, and actually work on the Judiciary Committee, I think it's too long, because what Ray's fighting in Georgia and what people are fighting all across the country are these voter suppression laws that keep getting passed over and over again, which wouldn't see the light of day if the 65 Civil Rights Act, the pre-clearance provision was restored. The reason why they're gonna delay HR 4 is to so-called make it litigation proof, which would, as a lawyer, I can tell you, that's gonna be very hard to do. All that being said, here's the good news. The good news is that there's more of us than there are of the far right wing. It's just that we're gonna have to be much more strategic, tactical, well-funded. We're a movement that is just embryonic, but we have to fully staff up. And, you know, I would say like the Greenpeace of election protection, but I think Ray and all your colleagues across the country, you've laid the groundwork to push back, but we're gonna have to have a conversation about more power. Thanks.
Well, it seems to me, and Joel, that's 100% from a guy who's been in Congress a long time. We have three major mountains to climb. We've got the gerrymandered state legislatures in places like Georgia, Florida, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, the Carolinas, Arizona in particular. Those states with their gerrymandered legislatures are wrecking havoc. And, you know, Georgia's is horrible what's going on there, and it's going on in all these states. I mean, having been in Ohio all these years, we got kind of used to it, but that's what the gerrymandered state legislatures are. Mountain number one. Mountain number two is the filibustered Senate. Right. I mean, we all know what the issue is. We all know how hard. I'm sure there's some very, very smart people in the U.S. Senate who are working to figure out, as Art has mentioned, how to get around the filibuster. And then number three, the mountain, you know, who knows what we're going to do about that, is the Supreme Court. So these three branches of government have, as they're currently constituted, have a strong vested interest in suppressing democracy. And, you know, these point by points, these are all the points that came out in 2020 and made 2020 probably the most democratic small D election in US history. And now we're seeing the backlash, because as someone who's writing a history of the United States, I can tell you that democracy, social democracy, has been the primary enemy of the establishment since, not only since the writing of the Constitution, but since the Puritans came to Boston, to go into the really deep weeds here. So that's what we're looking at. We got three big mountains to climb. Anybody got another one they can think of? Ray, do we need any more mountains?
We got a couple more questions.
No.
We got a couple more questions, Harvey.
I got a question, Harvey.
Oh, Mark? Was that Mark Carlin?
Yeah, I don't know what happened to my face. But anyway, a quick question. what, how does this differ HR 1 from HR 4 from the John Lewis bill? Does it, would HR 1 just cover everything and make the John Lewis bill not necessary?
No. And again, some of you other expert scholars on this jump in, but it's a totally different set of issues related to some very specific provisions that in HR 1 that would deal with a variety of voter suppression techniques specifically that we see on a day-to-day basis, plus all of the that I've been articulating, plus all of the other provisions of ethics and campaign finance and all of those things in HR 1, whereas HR 4 will deal with a lot of the historical components of voting discrimination.
Harvey.
Yes.
So Judiciary Committee staff told me that they purposely are introducing two different bills. They didn't want to bury HR 4 and HR 1 because HR 1 is like an omnibus bill, which means it's gotta go to different committees. They didn't want HR 4 to get stuck in HR 1. So HR 4 is strictly pre-clearance provision, restores the 1965 Civil Rights Act, whereas HR 1 is what Ray had talked about, but they didn't want to join them together.
Okay, very good. Laura Chamberlain and David Schlesinger. Laura?
Hey, hi. Some people are just saying that for some reason, because HR 1 has some funding mechanisms for different aspects, the machines and different commissions and things, that it can be handled under reconciliation. So Joel or Ray, do you know that if there's any way that reconciliation could be used for HR 1, or are we facing the filibuster? Thank you.
Good question.
That's what we've been talking about, and I don't know if they'll try that tactic on HR 1, but I know people are looking to use any kind of engineering that they can to get to 51, and I'm all for it, but I think they're going to have a steep hill to climb after they ram through the $1.9 trillion to try to come back with another big omnibus bill to use reconciliation. They could try, but again, I'm not the expert here.
Okay, we'll take that up after the recording is over. Thank you very much. James Fukuda, great to see you. Everybody who's joining me at the beach with Ted, we'll be back in Cancun next week. And thank you, everybody. It was a wonderful, wonderful call. We still have over 60 people on it. We will resume same time, same place, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific on Monday. That will be March 1st, actually, and Jennifer's meeting will be Friday, 5 p.m. Eastern. An amazing meeting. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you, Mike Shake. Thank you, Steve, Joel, Ray McClendon, so many of the rest of you. Okay, we're done. We're turning off the recording now.